The guards marched Davis Seaworth across a bridge of black basalt and under an iron portcullis showing signs of rust. Beyond lay a deep salt moat and a drawbridge supported by a pair of massive chains. Green water surged below, sending up plumes of spray to smash against the foundations of the castle. Then came a second gatehouse, larger than the first, its stones bearded with green algae. Davis stumbled across a muddy yard with his hands bound at the wrists. A cold rain stung his eyes. The guards prodded him up the steps into Breakwater's cavernous stone keep. Once inside, the captain removed his cloak and hung it from a peg so as not to leave puddles on the threadbare mirrorish carpet. Davis did the same, fumbling at the clasp with his bound hands. He had not forgotten the courtesies he had learned on Dragonstone during his years of service. They found the Lord alone in the gloom of his hall, making a supper of beer and bread and sister's stew. 20 iron sconces were mounted along the thick stone walls, but only 4 held torches, and none of them were lit. 2 fat tallow candles gave a meagre, flickering light. Davis could hear the rain lashing at the walls, and a steady dripping where the roof had sprung a leak. "My lord," said the captain, "we found this man in the belly of the whale, trying to buy his way off island. He had 12 dragons on him, and this thing, too." The captain put it on the table by the lord, a wide ribbon of black velvet trimmed with cloth of gold and bearing 3 seals, a crown stag stamped in golden beeswax, a flaming heart in red, a hand in white. Davis waited, wet and dripping, his wrists chafing where the wet rope dug into his skin. One word from this lord, and he would soon be hanging from the gallows gate of Sisterton. But at least he was out of the rain, with solid stone beneath his feet in place of a heaving deck. He was soaked and sore and haggard, worn thin by grief and betrayal, and sick to death of storms. The lord wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and picked up the ribbon for a closer squint. Lightning flashed outside, making the arrow loops blaze blue and white for half a heartbeat. 1, 2, 3, 4, Davis counted before the thunder came. When it quieted, he listened to the dripping and the duller roar beneath his feet, where the waves were smashing against Breakwater's huge stone arches and swirling through its dungeons. He might well end up down there, fettered to a wet stone floor and left to drown when the tide came rushing in. No, he tried to tell himself, a smuggler might die that way, but not a king's hand. I'm worth more if he sells me to his queen. The lord fingered the ribbon, frowning at the seals. He was an ugly man, big and fleshy, with an oarsman's thick shoulders and no neck. Coarse grey stubble, going white in patches, covered his cheeks and chin. Above a massive shelf of brow, he was bald. His nose was lumpy and red with broken veins, his lips thick, and he had a sort of webbing between the 3 middle fingers of his right hand. Davis had heard that some of the lords of the 3 sisters had webbed hands and feet, but he'd always put that down as just another sailor story. The lord leaned back. "Cut him free," he said, "and peel those gloves off him. I want to see his hands." The captain did as he was told. As he jerked up his captive's maimed left hand, the lightning flashed again, throwing the shadow of Davis Seaworth's shortened fingers across the blunt and brutal face of Godric Borrell, Lord of Sweet Sister. "Any man can steal a ribbon," the lord said, "but those fingers do not lie. You are the Onion Knight." "I have been called that, my lord." Davis was a lord himself, and had been a knight for long years now, but deep down he was still what he'd always been, a smuggler of common birth, who had bought his knighthood with a hold of onions and salt fish. "Oh, I've been called worse things, too. I, traitor, rebel, turn cloak." He bristled at the last. "I have never turned my cloak, my lord. I am a king's man. "Only if Stannis is a king." The lord weighed him with hard black eyes. "Most knights who land upon my shore seek me in my hall, not in the belly of the whale, a vile smuggler's den, that place. Are you returning to your old trade, onion knight?"
"No, my lord, I was looking for passage to White Arbor. The king sent me with a message for his lord."
"Then you're in the wrong place, with the wrong lord." Lord Godric seemed amused. "This is Sisterton on Sweet Sister."
"I know it is."
There was nothing sweet about Sisterton, though. It was a vile town, a sty, small and mean, and rank with the odours of pig shit and rotting fish. Davos remembered it well from his smuggling days. The Three Sisters had been a favourite haunt of smugglers for hundreds of years, and a pirate's nest before that. Sisterton's streets were mud and planks, its houses daub and wattle hovels, roofed with straw. And by the gallows gate there were always hanged men with their entrails dangling out.
"You have friends here, I do not doubt," said the lord. "Every smuggler has friends on the Sisters. Some of them are my friends as well. The ones who aren't, them I hang. I let them strangle slowly, with their guts slapping up against their knees."
The hall grew bright again as lightning lit the windows. Two heartbeats later came the thunder.
"If it is White Arbor that you want, why are you in Sisterton? What brought you here?"
"A king's command and a friend's betrayal," Davos might have said. Instead he answered, "Storms." 29 ships had set sail from the wall. If half of them were still afloat, Davos would be shocked. Black skies, bitter winds, and lashing rains had hounded them all the way down the coast. The galleys Alido and Old Mother's Son had been driven onto the rocks at Skagos. The Isle of Unicorns and Cannibals, where even the Blind Bastard had feared to land. The Grey Cug, South of Sun, had foundered off the grey cliffs.
"Stannis will be paying for them," Salador San had fumed. "He will be paying for them with good gold, every one."
It was as if some angry god was exacting payment for their easy voyage north, when they had ridden a steady southerly from Dragonstone to the wall. Another gale had ripped away the rigging of the bountiful harvest, forcing Sala to have her taken under tow. 10 leagues north of Widow's Watch, the seas rose again, slamming the harvest into one of the galleys towing her, and sinking both. The rest of the Lycine fleet had been scattered across the narrow sea. Some would straggle into one port or another, others would never be seen again.
"Salador the beggar, that's what your king has made me,"
Salador San complained to Davos as the remnants of his fleet limped across the bight.
"Salador the smashed. Where are my ships? And my gold? Where is all the gold that I was promised?"
When Davos had tried to assure him that he would have his payment, Sala had erupted.
"When? When? On the morrow? On the new moon? When the red comet comes again? He's promising me gold and gems, always promising. But this gold I've not seen. I have his word, he is saying. Oh, yes, his royal word. He writes it down. Can Salador San eat the king's word? Can he quench his thirst with parchments and waxy seals? Can he tumble promises into a feather bed and fuck them till they squeal?"
Davos had tried to persuade him to stay true. If Sala abandoned Stannis in his cause, he pointed out, he abandoned all hope of collecting the gold that was due him. A victorious King Tommen was not like to pay his defeated uncle's debts after all. Sala's only hope was to remain loyal to Stannis Baratheon until he won the Iron Throne. Elsewise he would never see a groat of his money. He had to be patient. Perhaps some lord with honey on his tongue might have swayed the Lycine pirate prince, but Davos was an onion knight, and his words had only provoked Sala to fresh outrage.
"On Dragonstone I was patient," he said, "when the red woman burned wooden gods and screaming men. All the long way to the wall I was patient. At Eastwatch I was patient, and cold, so very cold. Bah! I say bah to your patience, and bah to your king. My men are hungry. They are wishing to fuck their wives again, to count their sons, to see the stepstones and the pleasure gardens of lice. Ice and storms and empty promises, these they are not wanting. This north is much too cold and getting colder.
I knew the day would come, Davos told himself. I was fond of the old rogue, but never so great a fool as to trust him.
Storms. Lord Godric said the word as fondly as another man might say his lover's name. Storms were sacred on the Sisters before the Andals came. Our gods of old were the Lady of the Waves and the Lord of the Skies. They made storms every time they mated. He leaned forward. These kings never bother with the Sisters. Why should they? We are small and poor, and yet you're here, delivered to me by the storms.
Delivered to you by a friend, Davos thought.
Lord Godric turned to his captain. Leave this man with me. He was never here.
No, my lord, never.
The captain took his leave, his wet boots leaving damp footprints across the carpet. Beneath the floor, the sea was rumbling and restless, pounding at the castle's feet. The outer door closed with a sound like distant thunder, and again the lightning came, as if in answer.
My lord, said Davos, if you would send me unto White Harbor, his grace would count it as an act of friendship.
I could send you to White Harbor, Lord allowed, or I could send you to some cold, wet hell.
Sisterton is hell enough.
Davos feared the worst. The three sisters were fickle bitches, loyal only to themselves. Supposedly they were sworn to the Aerons of the Vale, but the Eyrie's grasp upon the islands was tenuous at best. Sunderland would require me to hand you over, if he knew of you. Burrell did fealty for Sweet Sister, as Longthought did for Long Sister, and Torrent for Little Sister. All were sworn to Tristan Sunderland, the lord of the three sisters. He'd sell you to the queen for a pot of that Lannister gold. Poor man needs every dragon, with seven sons all determined to be knights. The lord picked up a wooden spoon and attacked his stew again. I used to curse the guards who only gave me daughters, until I heard Tristan bemoaning the cost of destriers. You'd be surprised to know how many fish it takes to buy a decent suit of plate and mail.
I had seven sons as well, but four are burned and dead.
Lord Sunderland is sworn to the Eyrie, Davos said. By rights he should deliver me to Lady Erin. He would stand a better chance with her than with the Lannisters, he judged. Though she had taken no part in the War of the Five Kings, Lysa Erin was a daughter of Riveron, an aunt to the young wolf.
Lysa Aeron's dead, Lord Godric said, murdered by some singer. Lord Littlefinger rules the Vale now. Where are the pirates?
When Davos did not answer, he rapped his spoon against the table.
The Lyseni. Torrent spied their sails from Little Sister, and before him the Flints from Widow's Watch, orange sails and green and pink. Salador San, where is he?
At sea.
Salo would be sailing around the Fingers and down the narrow sea. He was returning to the Stepstones with what few ships remained him. Perhaps he would acquire a few more along the way, if he came upon some likely merchantman.
A little piracy to help the leagues go by.
His Grace had sent him south to trouble the Lannisters and their friends.
The lie was one he had rehearsed as he rode towards Sisterton through the rain. Soon or late, the world would learn that Salador San had abandoned Stannis Baratheon, leaving him without a fleet, but they would not hear it from the lips of Davos Seaworth. Lord Godric stirred his stew.
Did that old pirate, son, make you swim to shore?
I came ashore in an open boat, my lord.
Sella had waited until the beacon of the night lamp shone off the Valerian's port bow before he put him off. Their friendship had been worth that much at least. The Lysene would gladly have taken him south with him, he avowed, but Davos had refused. Stannis needed Wyman Manderly, and had trusted Davos to win him. He would not betray that trust, he told Sala.
Bah! The pirate prince replied. He will kill you with these honours, O friend, he will kill you.
I've never had a king's hand beneath my roof before, Lord Godric said. Would Stannis ransom you, I wonder?
Would he?
Stannis had given Davos lands and titles and offices, but would he pay a good gold to buy back his life?
He has no gold, else he'd still have Sala.
You will find his grace at Castle Black, if my lord would like to ask that of him.
Burrell grunted. Is the imp at Castle Black as well?
The imp?
Davos did not understand the question.
He is at King's Landing, condemned to die for the murder of his nephew.
The wall is the last to learn, my father used to say. The dwarfs escaped. He twisted through the bars of his cell and tore his own father apart with his bare hands. A guardsman saw him flee, red from head to heel, as if he'd bathed in blood. The queen will make a lord of any man who kills him.
Davos struggled to believe what he was hearing.
You're telling me that Tywin Lannister is dead?
At his son's hand, aye.
The lord took a drink of beer.
When there were kings on the sisters, we did not suffer dwarfs to live. We cast them all into the sea as an offering to the gods. The Septons made us stop that.
A pack of pious fools, why would the gods give a man such a shape but to mark him as a monster?
Lord Tywin dead? This changes all. My lord, will you grant me leave to send a raven to the wall? His grace will want to know of Lord Tywin's death.
He'll know, but not for me, nor you, so long as you're here beneath my leaky roof. I'll not have it said that I gave Stannis aid and counsel.
The Sunderlands dragged the sisters into two of the Blackfyre rebellions, and we all suffered grievously for that. Lord Godric waved his spoon towards a chair.
Sit before you fall, sir.
My hall is cold and damp and dark, but not without some courtesy. We'll find dry clothes for you, but first you'll eat. He shouted, and a woman entered the hall.
We have a guest to feed. Bring beer and bread and sister's stew.
The beer was brown, the bread black, the stew a creamy white. She served it in a trencher hollowed out of a stale loaf. It was thick with leeks, carrots, barley, and turnips, white and yellow, along with clams and chunks of cod and crab meat, swimming in a stock of heavy cream and butter. It was the sort of stew that warmed a man right down to his bones. Just the thing for a wet, cold night. Davos spooned it up gratefully.
You have tasted sister's stew before?
I have, my lord.
The same stew was served all over the three sisters, in every inn and tavern.
This is better than what you've had before. Gela makes it, my daughter's daughter. Are you married on your night?
I am, my lord.
A pity, Gela's not. Homely women make the best wives. There's three kinds of crabs in there, red crabs and spider crabs and conquerors. I won't eat spider crab, except in sister's stew. Makes me feel half a cannibal.
His lordship gestured at the banner hanging above the coal-black hearth. A spider crab was embroidered there, white on a grey-green field. We heard tales that Stannis burned his hand.
The hand who went before me.
Melisandre had given Alistair Florent to her guard on Dragonstone to conjure up the wind that bore them north. Lord Florent had been strong and silent as the Queen's men bound him to the post, as dignified as any half-naked man could hope to be. But as the flames licked up his legs, he had begun to scream, and his screams had blown them all the way to Eastwatch by the sea, if the Red Woman could be believed. Davos had misliked that wind. It had seemed to him to smell of burning flesh, and the sound of it was anguished as it played amongst the lines. It could as easily have been me. I did not burn, he assured Lord Godric, though Eastwatch almost froze me. The wall will do that. The woman brought them a fresh loaf of bread, still hot from the oven. When Davos saw her hand, he stared. Lord Godric did not fail to make note of it. Aye, she has a mark, like all Borrels, for 5,000 years. My daughter's daughter, not the one who makes the stew. He tore the bread apart and offered half to Davos. Eat, it's good. It was, though any stale crust would have tasted just as fine to Davos. It meant he was a guest here, for this one night at least. The lords of the Three Sisters had a black repute, and none more so than Godric Borrell, lord of Sweet Sister, shield of Sisterton, master of Breakwater Castle, and keeper of the Night Lamp. But even robber lords and wreckers were bound by the ancient laws of hospitality. "I will see the dawn at least," Davos told himself. "I've eaten of his bread and salt." Though there were stranger spices than salt in this sister's stew. "Is it saffron that I'm tasting?" Saffron was worth more than gold. Davos had only tasted once before, when King Robert had sent half a fish to him at a feast on Dragonstone. "Aye, from Cars. There's pepper, too." Lord Godric took a pinch between his thumb and forefinger and sprinkled his own trencher. "Cracked black pepper from Volantis, nothing finer. Take as much as you require, if you're feeling peppery. I've got 40 chests of it, not to mention cloves and nutmeg, and a pound of saffron. Took it off a slow-eyed maid." He laughed. He still had all his teeth, Davos saw, though most of them were yellow, and one on the top was black and dead. "She was making for Braavos, but a gale swept her into the bight, and she smashed up against some of my rocks. So you see, you're not the only gift the storms have brought me. The sea's a treacherous, cruel thing." "Not as treacherous as men," thought Davos. Lord Godric's forebears had been pirate kings until the Starks came down on them with fire and sword. These days the sister men left open piracy to Salador San and his ilk, and confined themselves to wrecking. The beacons that burned along the shores of the Three Sisters were supposed to warn of shoals and reefs and rocks and lead the way to safety. But on stormy nights and foggy ones, some sister men would use false lights to draw unwary captains to their dooms. "The storms did you a kindness, blowing you to my door," Lord Godric said. "You'd have found a cool welcome in White Harbour." "You come too late, sir. Lord Wyman means to bend his knee, and not to Stannis." He took a swallow of his beer. "The Mandalays are no Northmen, not deep down. 'Twas no more than 900 years ago when they came north, laden down with all their gold and gods. Oh, they'd been great lords on the Mander, until they overreached themselves, and the Green Hands slapped them down. The Wolf King took their gold, but he gave them land, and let them keep their gods." He mopped at his stew with a chunk of bread. "If Stannis thinks the fat man will ride the stag, he's wrong. The Lion Star put in at Sisterton 12 days ago to fill her water casks. Do you know her? Crimson sails and a gold line on her prow, and full of Freys making for White Harbour." "Freys?" That was the last thing that Davos would have expected. "The Freys killed Lord Wyman's son, we heard." "Aye," Lord Godric said, and the fat man was so wroth that he took a vow to live on bread and wine till he had his vengeance. But before the day was out, he was stuffing clams and cakes into his mouth again. There's ships that go between the Sisters and White Harbour all the time. We sell them crabs and fish and goat cheese. They sell us wood and wool and hides. From all I hear, his lordship's fatter than ever. So much for vows. Words are wind, and the wind from Manderley's mouth means no more than the wind escaping out his bottom. The Lord tore off another chunk of bread to swipe out his trencher. The Freys were bringing the fat fool a bag of bones. Some call that courtesy, to bring a man his dead son's bones. Had it been my son, I would have returned the courtesy and thanked the Freys before I hanged them. But the fat man's too noble for that. He stuffed the bread into his mouth, chewed and swallowed. I had the Freys to supper. One sat just where you're sitting now. Rhaegar, he named himself. I almost laughed right in his face. He'd lost his wife, he said, but he meant to get himself a new one in White Harbour. Ravens have been flying back and forth. Lord Wyman and Lord Walder have made a pact, and mean to seal it with a marriage. Davos felt as though the Lord had punched him in the belly. If he tells it true, my king is lost. Stannis Baratheon had desperate need of White Harbour. If Winterfell was the heart of the North, White Harbour was its mouth. Its firth had remained free of ice even in the depths of winter for centuries. With winter coming on, that could mean much and more. So could the city's silver. The Lannisters had all the gold of Casterly Rock and had wed the wealth of Highgarden. King Stannis' coffers were exhausted.
I must try, at least. There may be some way that I can stop this marriage.
I have to reach White Harbour, he said. Your lordship, I beg you, help me.
Lord Godric began to eat his trencher, tearing it apart in his big hands. The stew had softened the stale bread.
I have no love for Northmen, he announced. The maesters say the rape of the three sisters was 2,000 years ago, but Sisterton has not forgotten. We were a free people before that, with our kings ruling over us. Afterward, we had to bend our knees to the Eyrie to get the Northmen out. The Wolf and the Falcon fought over us for 1,000 years, till between the two of them they had gnawed all the fat and flesh off the bones of these poor islands. As for your King Stannis, when he was Robert's master of ships, he sent a fleet into my port without my leave, and made me hang 12 fine friends, men like you. He went so far as to threaten to hang me, if it should happen that some ship went aground because the night lamp had gone black. I had to eat his arrogance. He ate some of the trencher. Now he comes north, humbled, with his tail between his legs. Why should I give him any aid? Answer me that.
Because he's your rightful king, Davos thought. Because he is a strong man and a just one, the only man who can restore the realm and defend it against the peril that gathers in the north. Because he has a magic sword that glows with the light of the sun.
The words caught in his throat. None of them would sway the Lord of Sweet Sister. None of them would get him a foot closer to White Harbour.
What answer does he want? Must I promise him gold we do not have? A high-born husband for his daughter's daughter? Lands, honours, titles?
Lord Alistair Florent had tried to play that game, and the king had burned him for it.
The Ander's lost his tongue, it seemed. He has no taste for sister's stew, or truth.
Lord Godric wiped his mouth.
The lion is dead, said Davos slowly.
There's your truth, my lord. Tywin Lannister is dead.
What if he is?
Who rules now in King's Landing? Not Tommen. He's just a child. Is it Sir Kevin?
Candlelight gleamed in Lord Godric's black eyes.
If it were, you'd be in chains. It's the Queen who rules.
Davos understood.
He nurses doubts. He does not want to find himself upon the losing side. Stannis hailed Storm's End against the Tyrells and the Redwynes. He took Dragonstone from the last Targaryens. He smashed the Iron Fleet off Fair Isle. This child king will not prevail against him.
This child king commands the wealth of Casterly Rock and the power of Highgarden. He has the Boltons and the Freys.
Lord Godric rubbed his chin.
Still, in this world only winter is certain. Ned Stark told my father that here, in this very hall.
Ned Stark was here?
At the dawn of Robert's Rebellion. The Mad King had sent to the Eyrie for Stark's head, but John Arryn sent him back to Fiance. Galtown stayed loyal to the throne, though. To get home and call his banners, Stark had to cross the mountains to the Fingers and find a fisherman to carry him across the Bight. A storm caught them on the way. The fisherman drowned, but his daughter got Stark to the sisters before the boat went down. They say he left her with a bag of silver and a bastard in her belly. John Snow, she named him, after Arryn. Be that as it may, my father sat where I sit now when Lord Eddard came to Sisterton. Our maester urged us to send Stark's head to Aerys to prove our loyalty. It would have meant a rich reward. The Mad King was open-handed with them as pleased him. By then we knew that John Arryn had taken Galtown, though. Robert was the first man to gain the wall, and slew Mark Grafton with his own hand. This Baratheon is fearless, I said. He fights the way a king should fight. Our maester chuckled at me and told us that Prince Rhaegar was certain to defeat this rebel. That was when Stark said, in this world only winter is certain. We may lose our heads, it's true, but what if we prevail? My father sent him on his way with his head still on his shoulders. If you lose, he told Lord Eddard, you were never here.
No more than I was, said Davos Seaworth.
Baelor of House Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, Hand of the King, Protector of the Realm, and heir apparent to the Iron Throne of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros, went to the fire in the yard of Ashford Castle on the north bank of River Cockleswent. Other great houses might choose to bury their dead in the dark earth or sink them in the cold green sea, but the Targaryens were the blood of the dragon, and their ends were writ in flame. He had been the finest knight of his age, and some argued that he should have gone to face the dark clad in mail and plate, a sword in his hand. In the end, though, his royal father's wishes prevailed, and Daeron the Second had a peaceable nature. When Dunk shuffled past Baelor's bier, the prince wore a black velvet tunic with the three-headed dragon picked out in scarlet thread upon his breast. Around his throat was a heavy gold chain. His sword was sheathed by his side, but he did wear a helm, a thin golden helm with an open visor so men could see his face. Valar, the young prince, stood vigil at the foot of the bier while his father lay in state. He was a shorter, slimmer, handsomer version of his sire, without the twice-broken nose that had made Baelor seem more human than royal. Valar's hair was brown, but a bright streak of silver gold ran through it. The sight of it reminded Dunk of Arryn, but he knew that that was not fair. Egg's hair was growing back as bright as his brother's, and Egg was a decent enough lad for a prince. When he stopped to offer awkward sympathies, well larded with thanks, Prince Valar blinked cool blue eyes at him and said,
"My father was only 39. He had it in him to be a great king, the greatest since Aegon the Dragon. Why would the gods take him and leave you?"
He shook his head.
"Be gone with you, Sir Duncan. Be gone."
Wordless, Dunk limped from the castle down to the camp by the green pool. He had no answer for Valar, nor for the questions he asked himself. The maesters and the boiling wine had done their work, and his wound was healing cleanly, though there would be a deep, puckered scar between his left arm and his nipple. He could not see the wound without thinking of Baelor.
"He saved me once with his sword, and once with a word, even though he was a dead man as he stood there."
The world made no sense when a great prince died so a hedge knight might live. Dunk sat beneath his elm and stared morosely at his foot. When four guardsmen in the royal livery appeared in his camp late one day, he was sure they had come to kill him after all. Too weak and weary to reach for a sword, he sat with his back to the elm, waiting.
"Our prince begs the favor of a private word."
"Which prince?"
asked Dunk, wary.
"This prince,"
a brusque voice said before the captain could answer. Makar Targaryen walked out from behind the elm. Dunk got slowly to his feet.
"What would he have of me now?"
Makar motioned, and the guards vanished as suddenly as they had appeared. The prince studied him a long moment, then turned and paced away from him to stand beside the pool, gazing down at his reflection in the water.
"I have sent Arion to Lys,"
he announced abruptly.
"A few years in the Free Cities may change him for the better."
Dunk had never been to the Free Cities, so he did not know what to say to that. He was pleased that Arion was gone from the Seven Kingdoms and hoped he never came back, but that was not a thing you told a father of his son. He stood silent. Prince Makar turned to face him.
"Some men will say I meant to kill my brother. The gods know it is a lie, but I will hear the whispers till the day I die. And it was my mace that dealt the fatal blow, I have no doubt. The only other foes he faced in the melee were three Kingsguard, whose vows forbade them to do any more than defend themselves. So it was me. Strange to say, I do not recall the blow that broke his skull. Is that a mercy or a curse?"
"Some of both, I think."
From the way he looked at Dunk, it seemed the prince wanted an answer.
"I could not say, Your Grace."
Perhaps he should have hated Makar, but instead he felt a queer sympathy for the man.
"You swung the mace, my lord, but it was for me Prince Baylor died. So I killed him too, as much as you."
"Yes," the prince admitted. "You'll hear them whisper as well. The king is old. When he dies, Valar will climb the Iron Throne in place of his father. Each time a battle is lost or a crop fails, the fools will say, 'Baylor would not have let it happen. But the Hedge Knight killed him.'"
Dunk could see the truth in that.
"If I had not fought, you would have had my hand off, and my foot. Sometimes I sit under that tree, there, and look at my feet, and ask if I couldn't have spared one. How could my foot be worth a prince's life? And the other two as well, the Humphreys. They were good men too."
Sir Humphrey Harding had succumbed to his wounds only last night.
"And what answer does your tree give you?"
"None that I can hear. But the old man, Sir Arlen, every day at evenfall he'd say, 'I wonder what the morrow will bring.' He never knew, no more than we do. Well, mightn't it be that some morrow will come when I'll have need of that foot? When the realm will have need of that foot even more than a prince's life?"
Makar chewed on that a time, mouth clenched beneath the silvery pale beard that made his face seem so square.
"It's not bloody likely," he said harshly. "The realm has as many hedge knights as hedges, and all of them have feet."
"If your grace has a better answer, I'd want to hear it."
Makar frowned.
"It may be that the gods have a taste for cruel japes, or
perhaps there are no gods.
Perhaps none of this had any meaning. I'd ask the High Septon, but the last time I went to him, he told me that no man can truly understand the workings of the gods. Perhaps he should try sleeping under a tree."
He grimaced.
"My youngest son seems to have grown fond of you, sir. It is time he was a squire, but he tells me he will serve no knight but you. He is an unruly boy, as you will have noticed. Will you have him?"
"Me?"
Dunk's mouth opened and closed and opened again.
Aegon, I mean, he is a good lad, but Your Grace, I know you honor me, but I am only a hedge knight."
"That can be changed," said Makar. "Aegon is to return to my castle at Summerhall. There is a place there for you, if you wish. A knight of my household? You'll swear your sword to me, and Aegon can squire for you. While you train him, my
Master-at-arms will finish your own training, hm? The prince gave him a shrewd look. Your Sir Arlen did all he could for you, I have no doubt. But you still have much to learn.
I know, my lord.
Dunk looked about him. At the green grass and the reeds, the tall elm, the ripples dancing across the surface of the sunlit pool. Another dragonfly was moving across the water, or perhaps it was the same one.
What shall it be, Dunk? He asked himself. Dragonflies? Or dragons?
A few days ago, he would have answered at once. It was all he had ever dreamed. But now that the prospect was at hand, it frightened him.
Just before Prince Baylor died, I swore to be his man.
Presumptuous of you, said Makar. What did he say?
That the realm needed good men.
That's true enough. What of it?
I will take your son as squire, your grace, but not at Summerhall. Not for a year or two. He's seen sufficient of castles, I would judge. I'll have him only if I can take him on the road with me. He pointed to Old Chestnut. He'll ride my steed, wear my old cloak, and he'll keep my sword sharp and my mail scoured. We'll sleep in inns and stables, and now and again in the halls of some landed knight or lesser lordling, and maybe under trees when we must.
Prince Makar gave him an incredulous look.
Did the trial addle your wits, man? Aegon is a prince of the realm, the blood of the dragon. Princes are not made for sleeping in ditches and eating hard salt beef.
He saw Dunk hesitate.
What is it you're afraid to tell me? Say what you will, sir.
Darren never slept in a ditch, I'll wager, said Dunk very quietly. And all the beef that Arion ever ate was thick and rare and bloody, like as not.
Maegar Targaryen, Prince of Summerhall, regarded Dunk of Fleabottom for a long time, his jaw working silently beneath his silvery beard. Finally, he turned and walked away, never speaking a word. Dunk heard him riding off with his men. When they were gone, there was no sound but the faint thrum of the dragonfly's wings as it skimmed across the water. The boy came the next morning, just as the sun was coming up. He wore old boots, brown breeches, a brown wool tunic, and an old traveler's cloak.
My lord father says I am to serve you.
Serve you, sir, Dunk reminded him.
You can start by saddling the horses. Chestnut is yours. Treat her kindly. I don't want to find you on Thunder unless I put you there.
Egg went to get the saddles.
Where are we going, sir?
Dunk thought for a moment.
I have never been over the Red Mountains.
Would you like to have a look at Dorne?
Egg grinned.
I hear they have good puppet shows, he said.
The leaden sky was spitting down rain in earnest as John the Fiddler and Ser Galtry the Green took up fresh lances at opposite ends of the lists. Some of the wedding guests were streaming off toward the great hall, huddled under cloaks. Ser Galtry rode a white stallion. A drooping green plume adorned his helm, a matching plume his horse's crinet. His cloak was a patchwork of many squares of fabric, each a different shade of green. Gold inlay made his greaves and gauntlet glitter, and his shield showed 9 jade mullets upon a leek-green field. Even his beard was dyed green in the fashion of the men of Tyrosh across the narrow sea. 9 times he and the fiddler charged with leveled lances, the green patchwork knight and the young lordling of the golden swords and fiddles, and 9 times their lances shattered. By the 8th run, the ground had begun to soften, and the big destriers splashed through pools of rainwater. On the 9th, the fiddler almost lost his seat, but recovered before he fell. "Well struck!" he called out, laughing. "You almost had me down, sir!" "Soon enough!" the green knight shouted through the rain. "No, I think not!" The fiddler tossed his splintered lance away, and a squire handed him a fresh one. The next run was their last. Ser Galtry's lance scraped ineffectually off the fiddler's shield, whilst Sir John's took the Green Knight squarely in the center of the chest and knocked him from his saddle to land with a great brown splash. In the east, Dunk saw the flash of distant lightning. The viewing stands were emptying out quickly as small folk and lordlings alike scrambled to get out of the wet. "See how they run," murmured Alan Cockshaw as he slid up beside Dunk. "A few drops of rain and all the bold lords go squealing for shelter. What will they do when the real storm breaks, I wonder?" The real storm. Dunk knew Lord Alan was not talking about the weather. What does this one want? Has he suddenly decided to befriend me? The herald mounted his platform once again. Sir Tomard Heddle, a knight of White Walls in service to Lord Butterwell, he shouted as thunder rumbled in the distance. Sir Uthor Underleaf, come forth and prove your valor. Dunk glanced over at Sir Uthor in time to see the snail's smile go sour. This is not the match he paid for. The master of the games had crossed him up. But why? Someone else has taken a hand. Someone Cosgrove esteems more than Uthor Underleaf. Dunk chewed on that for a moment. They do not know that Uthor does not mean to win, he realized all at once. They see him as a threat. So they mean for Black Tom to remove him from the Fiddler's Path. Heddle himself was part of Peek's conspiracy. He could be relied on to lose when the need arose, which left no one but... And suddenly Lord Peek himself was storming across the muddy field to climb the steps to the Herald's platform, his cloak flapping behind him.
"We are betrayed," he cried. "Blood Raven has a spy amongst us. The dragon's egg is stolen."
Sir John the Fiddler wheeled his mount around.
"My egg? How is that possible? Lord Butterwell keeps guards outside his bedchamber night and day."
"Slain," Lord Peek declared, "but one man named his killer before he died."
"Does he mean to accuse me?" Dunk wondered. A dozen men had seen him touch the dragon's egg last night, when he'd carried Lady Butterwell to her lord husband's bed. Lord Gorman's finger stabbed down in accusation.
"There he stands, the whore's son! Seize him!"
At the far end of the lists, Sir Glendon Ball looked up in confusion. For a moment he did not appear to comprehend what was happening, until he saw men rushing at him from all directions. Then the boy moved more quickly than Dunk could have believed. He had his sword half out of its sheath when the first man threw an arm around his throat. Ball wrenched free of his grip, but by then two more of them were on him. They slammed into him and dragged him down into the mud. Other men swarmed over them, shouting and kicking. That could be me, Dunk realized. He felt as helpless as he had at Ashford, the day they'd told him he must lose a hand and a foot. Alan Cockshaw pulled him back. "Stay out of this if you want to find that squire of yours." Dunk turned on him.
"What do you mean?"
"I may know where to find the boy."
"Where?"
Dunk was in no mood for games. At the far end of the field, Sir Glendon was yanked roughly back onto his feet, pinioned between two men-at-arms in mail and half-helms. He was brown with mud from waist to ankle, and blood and rain washed down his cheeks. Hero's blood, thought Dunk, as Black Tom dismounted before the captive.
"Where's the egg?"
Blood dribbled from Ball's mouth.
"Why would I steal the egg? I was about to win it."
"Aye," thought Dunk, and that they could not allow. Black Tom slashed Ball across the face with a mailed fist.
"Search his saddlebags," Lord Peek commanded. "We'll find the dragon's egg wrapped up and hidden, I'll wager."
Lord Alan lowered his voice.
"And so they will. Come with me if you want to find your squire. There's no better time than now whilst they're all occupied."
He did not wait for a reply. Dunk had to follow. Three long strides brought him abreast of the lordling.
"If you have done Egg any harm,
Boys are not to my taste. This way, step lively now. Through an archway, down a set of muddy steps, around a corner, Dunk stalked after him, splashing through puddles as the rain fell around them. They stayed close to the walls, cloaked in shadows, finally stopping in a closed courtyard where the paving stones were smooth and slick. Buildings pressed close on every side. Above were windows, closed and shuttered. In the center of the courtyard was a well ringed with a low stone wall. A lonely place, Dunk thought. He did not like the feel of it. Old instinct made him reach for his sword hilt before he remembered that the snail had won his sword. As he fumbled at his hip where his scabbard should have hung, he felt the point of a knife poke his lower back. Turn on me and I'll cut your kidney out and give it to Butterwell's cooks to fry up for the feast. The knife pushed in through the back of Dunk's jerkin, insistent. Over to the well. No sudden moves, sir. If he has thrown Egg down that well, he will need more than some little toy knife to save him. Dunk walked forward slowly. He could feel the anger growing in his belly. The blade at his back vanished. You may turn and face me now, hedge knight. Dunk turned. My lord, is this about the dragon's egg? No, this is about the dragon. Did you think I would stand by and let you steal him? Sir Alan grimaced. I should have known better than to trust that wretched snail to kill you. I'll have my gold back, every coin. Him? Dunk thought. This plump, pasty-faced, perfumed lordling is my secret enemy? He did not know whether to laugh or weep. Sir Uthor earned his gold. I have a hard head, is all. So it seems. Back away. Dunk took a step backwards. Again. Again. Once more. Another step and he was flush against the well, its stones pressed against his lower back. Sit down on the rim. Not afraid of a little bath, are you? You cannot get much wetter than you are right now. I cannot swim. Dunk rested a hand on the well. The stones were wet. One moved beneath the pressure of his palm. What a shame! Will you jump or must I prick you? Dunk glanced down. He could see the raindrops dimpling the water a good 20 feet below. The walls were covered with a slime of algae. I never did you any harm, and never will. Daemon's mine. I will command his king's guard. You are not worthy of a white cloak. I never claimed I was. Daemon. The name rang in Dunk's head. Not John. Daemon. After his father. Dunk the Lunk, thick as a castle wall. Daemon Blackfyre sired 7 sons. 2 died upon the red grass field, twins. Aegon and Aemon, wretched, witless bullies just like you. When we were little, they took pleasure in tormenting me and Daemon both. I wept when Bittersteel carried him off to exile, and again when Lord Peak told me he was coming home. But then he saw you upon the road, and forgot that I existed. Cockshaw waved his dagger threateningly. You can go into the water as you are, or you can go in bleeding. Which will it be? Dunk closed his hand around the loose stone. It proved to be less loose than he had hoped. Before he could wrench it free, Sir Alan lunged. Dunk twisted sideways, so the point of the blade sliced through the meat of his shield arm. And then the stone popped free. Dunk fed it to his lordship and felt his teeth crack beneath the blow. The well, is it? He hit the lordling in the mouth again, then dropped the stone, seized Cockshaw by the wrist, and twisted until a bone snapped and the dagger clattered to the stones. After you, my lord. Sidestepping, Dunk yanked at the lordling's arm and planted a kick in the small of his back. Lord Alan toppled headlong into the well. There was a splash. Well done, sir! Dunk whirled. Through the rain, all he could make out was a hooded shape and a single pale white eye. It was only when the man came forward that the shadowed face beneath the cowl took on the familiar features of Ser Maynard Plum, the pale eye no more than the moonstone brooch that pinned his cloak at the shoulder. Down in the well, Lord Allen was thrashing and splashing and calling for help.
"Murder! Someone help me!"
"He tried to kill me," Dunk said. "That would explain all the blood." "Blood?" He looked down. His left arm was red from shoulder to elbow, his tunic clinging to his skin. "Oh." Dunk did not remember falling, but suddenly he was on the ground, with raindrops running down his face. He could hear Lord Allen whimpering from the well, but his splashing had grown feebler.
"We need to have that arm bound up."
Ser Maynard slipped his own arm under Dunk.
"Up now! I cannot lift you by myself! Use your legs!"
Dunk used his legs. "Lord Allen, he's going to drown."
"He shan't be missed, least of all by the fiddler."
"He's not..." Dunk gasped, pale with pain.
"A fiddler?" "No, he is Damon of House Blackfire, the second of his name, or so he would style himself if ever he achieves the Iron Throne. You would be surprised to know how many lords prefer their kings brave and stupid. Damon is young and dashing and looks good on a horse."
The sounds from the well were almost too faint to hear. "Shouldn't we throw his lordship down a rope?"
"Save him now to execute him later? I think not. Let him eat the meal that he meant to serve to you. Come, lean on me."
Plum guided him across the yard. This close, there was something queer about the cast of Ser Maynard's features. The longer Dunk looked, the less he seemed to see.
"I did urge you to flee, you will recall. But you esteemed your honor more than your life. An honorable death is well and good, but if the life at stake is not your own, what then?"
"Would your answer be the same, sir?" "Whose life?" From the well came one last splash. "Egg? Do you mean Egg?" Dunk clutched at Plum's arm. "Where is he?"
"With the gods, and you will know why, I think."
The pain that twisted inside Dunk just then made him forget his arm. He groaned. "He tried to use the boot."
"So I surmise. He showed the ring to Maester Lothair, who delivered him to Butterwell, who no doubt pissed his breeches at the sight of it and started wondering if he had chose the wrong side and how much Bloodraven knows of this conspiracy. The answer to that last is quite a lot."
Plum chuckled. "Who are you?"
"A friend," said Maynard Plum. "One who has been watching you and wondering at your presence in this nest of adders. Now be quiet until we get you mended."
Staying in the shadows, the two of them made their way back to Dunk's small tent. Once inside, Ser Maynard lit a fire, filled a bowl with wine, and set it on the flames to boil.
"A clean cut, and at least it is not your sword arm,"
he said, slicing through the sleeve of Dunk's blood-stained tunic.
"The thrust appears to have missed the bone. Still, we will need to wash it out, or you could lose the arm."
"It doesn't matter." Dunk's belly was roiling, and he felt as if he might retch at any moment. "If Egg is dead,
you bear the blame. You should have kept him well away from here. I never said the boy was dead, though. I said that he was with the gods. Do you have clean linen, silk?"
"My tunic, the good one I got in Dorne. What do you mean he's with the gods?"
"In good time. Your arm first."
The wine soon began to steam. Ser Maynard found Dunk's good silk tunic, sniffed at it suspiciously, then slid out a dagger and began to cut it up. Dunk swallowed his protest.
"Ambrose Butterwell has never been what you might call decisive,"
Ser Maynard said as he wadded up three strips of silk and dropped them in the wine.
"He had doubts about this plot from the beginning, doubts that were inflamed when he learned that the boy did not bear the sword. And this morning, his dragon's egg vanished, and with it the last dregs of his courage. Sir Glendon